Auto Business Radio podcast. Today I'm talking with Lee Van Onselen and David Llewellyn-Smith about negative gearing. Gentlemen, negative gearing of residential real estate has been a significant issue under discussion at Macro Business for a number of years. Leith and I did a podcast on it in May 2013. In the period since then, it's become a far more politically contentious issue, and in February 2016, the Australian Labor Party unveiled a policy position of removing negative gearing for existing property and making it only accessible for new construction, while at the same time grandfathering those currently using negative gearing for real estate after mid-2017 if it was to be successful in the upcoming federal election. That, as we all know, has seen a number of often spurious claims made about the possible impacts of this policy change in the political arena, across the media, and often pushed by the real estate lobby. Okay, Leith, with that as the backdrop, let's go back right to the very nub of the issue. Let's start with, what is negative gearing insofar as it relates to real estate?
Negative gearing is a tax arrangement that exists in Australia and New Zealand and a few other places that basically allows an investor in either property, shares, or some other form of investment to offset their net losses, their net investment losses against their current wages and salary income. And that's by and large unusual across the world. Like most countries quarantine investment losses in that they don't let you apply them against your unrelated wages and salary earnings. But in Australia, we don't do that. And on top of that, in Australia, we also have a 50% capital gains tax discount, which means that when the asset's eventually sold, only half the capital gain is taxed. So this has created a perverse incentive whereby you can offset all of your losses in, say, an investment property for as long as you want, for as long as the losses exist in unlimited amounts. There's no caps on it against your wages or salary earnings. And then if you sell the property for a big profit down the track, only 50% of the nominal gains are taxed. So not surprisingly, this has led to a surge of negatively geared investment.
So Australia's negative gearing regime, which allows losses on one investment class, in this case real estate, to be written off against other forms of income, for example, a salary, is considered to be unusually generous and supportive of real estate speculation. Is that right?
And in fact, the Australian Treasury came out recently, only a few months back, and admitted that Australia's negative gearing laws were favourable compared to most other countries. And also the current Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, released a tax paper back in 2005, which made the same conclusion.
Leith, if we go even further back than that, we know that in the mid-1980s, the then Treasurer, Paul Keating, tried to remove negative gearing on residential real estate. And one of the great myths which is being pushed into the media at the moment is that that attempt to remove negative gearing in the 1980s led to a surge in rents. Is that what happened?
Paul Keating as Treasurer in June 1985, temporarily restricted negative gearing and made it so that you can only apply investment losses against investment income. So you can no longer apply losses against your wages and salary earnings. And that removal lasted for just over 2 years. So negative gearing was reinstated back in September 1987. And the reason why it was re-implemented was because of heavy lobbying from the property lobby, who argued that negative gearing had pushed up rents and had caused a squeeze on construction. But the evidence shows that rents only rose in two jurisdictions. That's Sydney and Perth, whereas in every other jurisdiction, rents are either flat in inflation-adjusted terms or fell, which really does show that it's a myth that negative gearing did boost rents, because if that was true, you would have expected rents to have risen across Australia or at least across a majority of jurisdictions, not just two. And the Cabinet submission in 1987, which I have a copy of, actually notes that and says that rents have actually lagged CPI in Australia in the year before they reinstated negative gearing. And it also pins the blame for the high growth in rents in Sydney and Perth on very tight rental vacancies at the time, which are independent of the negative gearing policy.
Can I just add to that as well? During the two-year period when negative gearing was absent, house prices did fall 6% in real terms, but again, when you look at the context in which it was happening, and this plays into the rental story as well, inflation was very high. So in nominal terms, house prices didn't fall at all. But also, interest rates were going through the roof in that period. And in fact, in early 1985, they shot up a couple of percent. And so there was also a decline in construction in the period, but it's pretty clear that it derived from the big spike in interest rates, not from the removal of negative gearing. So when you look at the full picture of that 1985 to 1987 period, it's not that similar to today either, because there was also a quite large terms of trade shock underway. The Australian economy itself wasn't faring terribly well owing to high inflation, high interest rates, the terms of trade shock, and obviously a very high dollar at that point. So most of the impacts that were around were from these much bigger forces than anything to do with negative gearing.
From there, following the reintroduction of negative gearing in 1987, let's go forward to 1999, when the then Treasurer, Peter Costello, made changes to the application of capital gains tax, which made the negative gearing regime more attractive. Leith, can you explain how the changes in capital gains tax made negative gearing more attractive?
Prior to 1999, capital gains were taxed at one's top marginal tax rate, but they only taxed the real component of a capital gain. So what that means is that if you held an investment for, say, 5 years, and that investment had increased in value by 70%, but inflation had been 20% over that period, you would effectively get taxed on a 50% gain. And that tax would have been applied at your top marginal tax rate. So if you're on the 47% tax rate, you would pay 47% tax on that 50% gain. But what Peter Costello did in 1999 was he halved the rate of capital gains tax, but also removed the inflation indexing component. And because inflation has been very low since that time, it's basically increased the attractiveness of capital gains, because it's reduced one's tax rate on those capital gains. And up until 1999, the aggregate rental income on all investment properties was roughly even. But after the capital gains tax discount came in, aggregate rental losses skyrocketed until they hit a peak of nearly $10 billion a few years back. They're currently at about $8 billion. So Peter Costello's changes to the capital gains tax discount made negative gearing a lot more attractive, and also has dramatically increased the proportion of investors in the market.
That change you were talking about, with interest payments on mortgages considered a cost of business and therefore tax deductible for investors but not owner-occupiers, that encourages the greater use of debt by investors. How central has negative gearing been to the remarkable rise in private debt in Australia, nearly all of which goes into real estate, since the late 1990s?
Well, see, it's a capital gains tax discount was halved. It really has encouraged people to leverage up to the hilt and speculate in a property, knowing that they can claim any of their losses, their rental losses, against their wages and salary earning, but any capital gains that they get from the appreciation of that property will only get taxed at half. And because of this change, we've seen mortgage debt to GDP rise from about 42%. Back when the capital gains tax discount was halved, to nearly 94% currently. So that's more than double. And a lot of that growth has actually come from investment mortgages who've increased their share over that time. And obviously, this has placed upward pressure on house prices, because about 93% of property investors buy pre-existing dwellings. They're not buying new dwellings. And this is negative gearing combined with the capital gains tax discount has effectively artificially stoked the market.
David, you've written at length about Australia's houses and holds economy. What are your thoughts about a situation where we have a tax break underpinning investment in existing real estate funded by debt, which is itself largely sourced from offshore by a financial system which lends two-thirds for real estate and one-third for productive purposes? And how central do you think negative gearing is to that?
No, it's true. Most investors who buy a property these days try and gear up as much as possible.
And they also take on interest-only loans.
Yeah, they go 100% gearing if they can, and I'm assuming that's because of negative gearing. I'd probably put it in context of the economic model that it creates. I mean, for a long time, Australia has run an externally funded economic model. In fact, for most of its history. we've only run a current account surplus at very brief times. But what negative gearing tax regime has contributed to and is very central to, I think, is that it has sort of artificially inflated this demand for established housing. And to feed that, the banks, around the turn of the millennium, around the time of the capital gains tax cut by Peter Costello, there also was a bunch of deregulation of the financial system. And the banks mastered derivatives that allowed them to swap interest rate and currency risk in such a way that they could borrow offshore much more than they used to without being exposed to those risks. And so those two changes together meant that there was this sudden new demand for established property, and the money to feed that demand could very easily and relatively risk-free come from offshore. And so we ended up borrowing like crazy from offshore, and that long habit of externally funding our growth was supercharged. And over that period, the result has been much higher interest rate structure and much higher currency than we would have had otherwise. The implications of that are that we've given ourselves a form of kind of financial Dutch disease, where, you know, manufacturing and other tradable sectors and import competitors have been hollowed out as this borrowing and consumption model has taken hold and mushroomed hugely. Now, economists often argue that that was going to happen anyway, given the shift of a lot of industrial capacity from developed economies to emerging markets, just on the sheer base of labour competitiveness. But Australia didn't fight against that in any way. It went all in on this consumption, borrowing and consumption model, and so it accelerated it dramatically. And so we're in a position now where, you know, supposedly other hollowed out economies like the UK and the US have manufacturing contributions to GDP still in the 12 and 13% range, and we're down to 5. I mean, we're on a par with Luxembourg. I mean, we're the lowest in the OECD.
We are lowest in the OECD.
So, I mean, we've had other things going on, obviously a mining boom with a very high currency, but there's no doubt that a big contributor to that circumstance has been the borrow and consume model that is driven fundamentally by the negative gearing regime. So the macroeconomic implications of failing to address negative gearing can't be overstated. And yes, we've become wealthy and have the appearance of tremendous wealth with very high standards of living, but we have the debt to go with it. And it's a very high risk model, which shows up in the chronic and acute chronic account deficit that we run, and at some point may be forced to correct very suddenly, at which point the model will unravel.
Presumably it unravels when we don't have economic drivers enabling us to increase debt or even sustain the debt we've got in play. If we assume that negative gearing is central to taking billions of dollars off the revenue side of the budget, it inflates real estate prices, it leads to higher debt levels, which underpin a higher Australian dollar. How does negative gearing actually position us for the road ahead after we've had the massive debt binge and after the mining capex boom?
The hollowing out has been saved by the mining boom twice, and you know that added a lot of productive capacity to the economy in the commodities area, which helped backfill some of that, you know, financial hollowing out. But it also, you know, the mining boom itself was a very big cycle. It wasn't structural in the way that we misrepresented it. And so it's now coming off very fast as well and reverting to mean as China slows, and that's going to continue. And so that save that we got through mining is about to go missing, but we're still left with the hollowing out. And so unfortunately what we have done for the last 4 years is the RBA and Treasury deliberately blew another housing bubble as a way of kicking the can because they so misjudged the mining boom itself as kind of a panicked response. And when what we should have been doing was addressing the hollowing out, doing what we had to get the currency down, doing what we had to deflate ourselves internally and improve competitiveness, and that's how you address Dutch disease. So at this point, you know, as the mining boom finishes, we've done precisely the opposite of everything that we should have done. And so we find ourselves with our two great booms, hollowing out booms, finishing at the same time. And, you know, we'll face the very long and difficult task of having to rebuild our tradable drivers of growth. Now, we're positioned well on that front in some ways. The proximity to China and Asia is definitely an advantage. We're seeing that in tourism, which, you know, with the Chinese inflow is parabolic, and that's terrific. But those drivers are much smaller than the old ones, and so they simply can't grow fast enough to offset the declines in the old ones. And so that means you have a very long grinding period where you have to substitute your export income. But, you know, at this stage, we haven't even managed to reform negative gearing away, and so we're still fighting that self-imposed headwind in our own adjustment.
Okay, Leith, I'm going to bring you back in here. Let's go to the current Labor Party proposal. That proposal is that from mid-2017, if the Labor Party wins this year's federal election, then it will adopt a policy of only allowing negative gearing on new construction. To facilitate that and to facilitate the change from what we currently have, the Labor Party has said they will grandfather those currently using negative gearing so that they can continue to use it in future, but that from mid-2017, people looking to access negative gearing for the first time will only be able to do so if they're using it on a newly constructed dwelling. First question is, do you think that's a viable policy?
Yeah, look, I think it's a terrific proposal from the Labor Party. It's terrific from a political perspective and also from a policy perspective. Importantly, Labor has proposed to grandfather in current negative gearers, and that's important because what you don't want to see is a rule implemented retrospectively, obviously angering the 1.3 million or so current people who negatively gear, who, you know, invested in so-called good faith and have the rug pulled from under their feet. What it will also do is it will stop a stampede for the exits, whereby investors quickly rush to sell out because they're no longer getting their tax benefits and then possibly lead to a property crash. But the current negative gearing policy isn't working. And I should just say, Labor isn't just wanting to channel negative gearing. They also want to halve the capital gains tax discount to 25% from 50%.
So does that bring us broadly back into line with what we had prior to 1999?
Yeah, it is different because in 1999, capital gains were taxed at the full margin tax rate, so there was no discount. However, there was an inflation indexation component. So given that the inflation rate's likely to stay at around 2.5% for a long time because the days of high inflation are gone, halving the discount to about 25% would give you a policy that's roughly the same as what it was pre-1999, although the actual mechanics are a bit different. But getting back to the policy at hand, the current system of property tax perks isn't working. We have a situation where 93% of property investors, according to the housing finance stats, are buying pre-existing dwellings, and only 7% are buying new dwellings. And what this effectively means is that the overwhelming majority of investors are bidding up existing house prices but not adding to supply. And Chris Bowen, the shadow treasurer, is correct in saying that we have a 93% failure rate with the current negative gearing policy. So what Labor wants to do is channel that investment towards newly constructed dwellings, boost supply, boost construction, and put downward pressure on rents. And their proposal is 100% in concert with the government's policy on foreign investment, which does exactly the same thing.
What makes you say that?
The coalition government has recently held a foreign investment review whereby they came out and said, we want to encourage foreign investment, but only if it's in the national interest. And we want to encourage foreign investment if foreign investors purchase newly constructed dwellings because that boosts construction, boosts economic activity, boosts construction jobs, and creates more rental supply. So Labor's approach to negative gearing is 100% consistent with that approach and for exactly the same reasons.
Okay, Leith. Let's go from there to the major criticisms of the Labor policy. The first of those is that it will lead to a real estate price crash. How does that line of thought stack up?
I think it will certainly create some downward pressure on property prices, and that's because the overwhelming majority of investors at the moment are purchasing existing dwellings, and they would have less incentive to purchase existing dwellings if Labor's policy came in. And obviously, it would also stimulate supply, which would raise supply relative to demand and also put downward pressure on prices. But again, because Labor is grandfathering existing investors, it's not going to lead to a stampede. It's just going to put some downward pressure on new demand. And yes, there will be some short-term adjustment downwards in prices, but is that really a problem? I mean, we've had Australian housing is at its highest level ever relative to GDP, incomes, rents. It's insanely unaffordable. We have a whole generation of home buyers who are basically locked out of housing, creating massive intergenerational equity problems. We have Australian banks borrowing offshore like drunken sailors in order to meet the mortgage demand, and is having the highest house prices in the world and some of the most expensive housing and the highest private debt ratios in the world really desirable? You know, from a macroeconomic perspective, Labor's policies would unwind some of those imbalances, albeit with some minor pain in the short term, but that's the whole purpose of reform. You take a little bit of a hit in the short term for long-term gain, and Labor's policy does exactly that.
Dave, do you have any further points to add to that?
I'll just add that, as I said earlier, the two-year experiment in 85 to 87 saw house prices fall 6% in real terms. As I said, in nominal terms, they would have actually still probably gone up. So that's one experiment we could point to. However, at that point, the split between existing properties and new properties was more like 60-40 in favour of new. So the impact is likely to be larger this time. However, Lee's last point that this is actually a macroeconomic structural reform is very important. I mean, yes, house prices will take a hit, but that has immediate flow-on impacts for interest rates, and you will see them fall to offset that and prevent it becoming a contagion flowing into consumption or more widely. And then immediately as a result of that, you get a much lower dollar as well. And so you're already, the moment you do it, beginning to unwind the Dutch disease that you've afflicted yourself with for 30 years. And so you don't just see some sectors take a hit. You'd see other sectors get a boost, a big boost, and very much the boost that we need in the post-mining boom adjustment period. All of those import competitors will get a boost. All of our exports will get a boost. As all those commodity prices keep falling, all our miners will get a boost. Tax revenue will get a boost because the dollar is lower. The budget will be in a better state, even if some of the state budgets will take a hit on stamp duty. The federal budget will be better off. So there's a whole lot of swings and roundabouts in here that are never mentioned in the debate that basically mean, you know, there will be offsets to the hit to house prices. The other one was being that you will see increased new housing construction. So the fear campaign that's been mounted against this reform is pretty unscrupulous.
Yeah, can I also add just on that point that currently the way banks lend, the banks lending to businesses is at almost its lowest level in history, whereas its lending to housing is at its highest share in history. So we have a situation whereby housing lending is crowding out productive business lending, and with less mortgage demand through Labor's policy, we're likely to see banks start to focus more on business lending, which would be obviously good for the productive economy.
Absolutely. And there again, you know, you're creating a reliance on much more sustainable drivers of growth, where you're shifting your capital allocation in the economy from unproductive stuff like mortgages into productive investment, which obviously results in higher productivity for the economy overall and drives income growth, which is what living standards are all about. And you do all of that without adding to your debt.
One of the other commonly heard criticisms of the Labor policy is that it could lead to a surge in rental costs. Leith, what do you think is likely to be the impact on rents if negative gearing is removed on existing real estate from mid next year?
Well, I think there's no doubt that rents would actually fall relative to where they'd be otherwise. And it's very simple. There's a bit of a scare campaign being run that saying that investors will exit the rental market, therefore rental supply will fall and rents will rise. Well, it's wrong on two counts. To the extent that investors will stop investing in established dwellings, that's true. However, for every investor that doesn't buy an established dwelling, an owner-occupier does. And all that will effectively happen is that someone who would have been a renter becomes an owner-occupier. So rental supply falls by exactly the same proportion as rental demand, and there's no impact on rents in the existing market. However, Labor's policy by channeling negative gearing into new construction is going to lead to more housing supply, which will raise the rental stock overall. So Labor's policy will effectively increase overall housing supply, increase rental supply, and therefore lower rents, other things equal. So it's good policy from that perspective. It's good news for renters, and it's also good news for housing affordability in the longer term.
You've been listening to part one of a discussion with Leif Van Onselen and Dave Llewellyn-Smith about negative gearing, March 2016. Please join us for part two.